I want to start off by giving a brief recap of the weekend at Diamond Mountain. This is the start of the Phoenix version of the Lamrim teachings. But we held the first 3 days at Diamond Mountain so we could have quiet retreat teachings. And it's also Cinco de Mayo, which is a big holiday around here. Some of the retreatants have been speaking to us. They come out and they're blindfolded, but have given us, you know, some of their experiences and whatever. And it's been really inspiring. They'll be out of the 3-year retreat in about 11 months. So, it's gone quickly, it seems. But they've had this experience and have kind of been relating to us what realizations they've had and how easy some things have been and how difficult some things have been. Venerable Gyaltse gave a talk and she said, you know, it is said that in retreat you can reach single-pointed concentration in 3 months. And she said, maybe I'll do that in the next 3 months. She said, I've gotten really close, but not quite there yet. And then she gave a talk about, watching her mind, how it works, and parts that might be obstacles to things. And she said, she was talking using the metaphor that our life is a story or a series of stories that we kind of put together. And letting go of those stories is very difficult. She thinks that's what is keeping her from single-pointed concentration, because the mind, her mind, she said, but it certainly would apply to me too, is constantly making up stories about what's going on around, and those continue even when you're trying to meditate. I mean, if you're meditating on something, you're making up a story, basically. So that was a really beautiful teaching. And then John Brady, who's the leader of the retreat now, spoke yesterday. And at one point he said, and you do all these things, and you do yoga practice, and you study, and you do the sadhana sessions. And then at some point, all of a sudden, you're looking at a little tiny diamond right in the middle of your heart chakra. And for tantricas, that's a big thing. I can't tell you more about it, but he said, and then you get the idea. I mean, you're really convinced that the path's going to work. And he said, along with that comes a few minutes of very, very deep, concentrated bodhicitta, where your only thought, your only purpose for doing anything is to help other people. That there's that very deep feeling. A woman named Kendra spoke, and I'd known her. I mean, we hadn't talked a lot, but the person I was hearing speaking bore no resemblance to the person I knew 3 years, 2.5 years ago. It was just an amazing transformation. And Alejandro, who's not a retreatant, he runs the ACI Center in Guadalajara. Was up and he gave a talk. And he met Geshe-la and Lady Christie at San Pablo, which is a kind of a resort town in the Gulf of Mexico. To drive from here is maybe 6 hours, maybe not even that. But he was a surfer, and he was completely taken by what they said, and then he started coming to Diamond Mountain, and he was kind of a nice kid, I thought, cheerful, a little, mischievous maybe. But since the tantric teachings have finished and he's been working down there, Geshe-la told him that he had to teach. He's completely transformed. And he's got, I don't know how many people, 40 maybe, in the Sangha down there. They've been operating for 2.5 years, and they said we're halfway through the 18 ACI courses, which I find amazing. And they said there are a lot of young people. I'd always thought of Alejandro as mid-20s, something like that. I think he's maybe late 30s, actually. But he said it's really nice because there are so many young people that have been coming to these things. He brought one of these young people with him, 24 years old, something like that. I met him in Guadalajara, a really sweet young man. I think he's Mayan. His name is certainly not a Spanish name, Mexican name. And he's going to be giving a talk on working with the native peoples in Mexico and doing things. I think his talk's going to be on solar power, what they're doing there. So that was really inspiring. It's just been a wonderful weekend, and we're going to have another dose today when we finish this class. So, it gave me hope. I hope that gives you some hope. You know, this path really does work if you apply yourself. So, we're going to finish up last week's class. We were on the 8th verse of the mind training, which says, may none of this ever be made impure by the 8 ideas of things. May I see all things are illusion and free myself from the chains of attachment. And we said that the 8 ideas of things in the commentaries refer to 2 sets of 8. And one of them was the 8 worldly ideas, the 8 worldly thoughts, I guess, which we covered last week. And another one was the 8 ways to not see emptiness, to not understand emptiness, the 8 ways of seeing things as normal. So we're going to cover those 8 now. So, you know, we're doing Lojong. We're doing this practice for the benefit of others. You know, that's our Bodhisattva vows. That's Bodhicitta. You know, and we talked about last week about, you know, when we're unjustly accused or something like that, you know, that we should give the a benefit to others always. You know, we should give the profit to them. We should take the short end of the stick, which is a nice American, maybe even English expression, you know. We'll take the problems. We'll take the loss, you know, and give others the benefit. And in Lojong, we have to kind of draw a line. We don't make excuses about not doing this, you know, and people will come up to you, or you might come up to me or people to Geshe-la and say, well, but what about, you know, and give a thing. You know, I'll lose my job if I do this, or the company would fail, or something like that. And, you know, when you reach the point where you're really applying Lojong to your life, there are no exceptions. You draw a line in the dirt, you know, and you don't cross that. You always take the loss, and you always give the benefit to others. And that's why we're doing that. We can't let our Lojong get diluted. What does the verse say? May none of this ever be made impure by the 8 ideas of things. we can't pollute it. We can't dirty it. We've actually got to practice it. This particular Lojong text was kept secret. This verse was kept secret for several hundred years after it was written, because the teachers didn't think that people could handle it. They'd get the wrong idea. This is true of other Lojongs as well. We'll have another one today. You know, it's against our basic instincts to take the loss ourselves. And especially if we're not at fault, but we have to understand that if we're being treated unfairly, it is our fault. You know, it doesn't come from anything else but having treated others unfairly in the past. And we have to draw that line. We can't cross the line. We've been doing that, you know, since beginning of this time. And we keep on dying and getting reborn. So what we've been doing doesn't work. And now we just put, you know, you kind of put the flag in the stand. You know, this is where I stand. And nobody's going to move me from it. That's what we have to do. And to do this, we have to understand emptiness. If we're going to succeed at Lojong, we must have a really good idea of emptiness and always keep that in our mind. Chökyi Rinpoche, in his commentary on this text, you know, he taught that the eight ideas that Diamond Lion mentions, you know, really are about emptiness, that we can't practice Lojong unless we understand emptiness. We have to always keep that in mind, you know, that things aren't coming at us. They're coming from us. Even when we're being treated unfairly, it's not coming at us. We are generating that in our minds. It's the result of our karma. It's a projection. It's got nothing to do with anything out there at all. So if we fall into the eight worldly thoughts that we talked about in the last class, we don't understand emptiness. If we see things incorrectly, which we're going to cover right now, we don't understand emptiness. So what are these eight ways to see things incorrectly? They're called tagye. Ta means extreme and ge means eight. So these are eight wrong ideas, eight extremes. Geshe-la says they're like cliffs that we can fall off of. It means that there are eight wrong understandings about emptiness, you know, and these wrong understandings will pollute our Lojong practice, because if we have these eight wrong understandings, we really are not concerned with other people. We really think that things are not coming from us, but coming from out there. And we'll fail. Our failure will be painful to us, and ultimately it will kill us. We will die. So we'll go through what these eight wrong ideas are. In their nature is that things exist due to themselves in some way. There is an essence. There's an essential nature in things. Things have that. And they therefore exist from their own side. You know, the pen that you might be holding right now exists from its own side. It's a pen. It tells us that it is a pen. You know, a dog chewing on it doesn't understand. You know, it is a pen, and they just are stupid. They can't understand it. So that's the basis of these wrong ideas. You know, we're looking at a blue and white cylinder or whatever color your pen is. And what we're seeing instead is a pen and not a blue and white cylinder. We are forced by our karma to make this into a pen. And a dog is forced by its karma to make it into a chew stick. So these eight extremes come from a text by Arya Nagarjuna. And the first extreme, say, Kewa Mepa.
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 Yeah. Things don't start from their own side. Kewa Mepa means nothing starts. You know, so what this means is the pen does not come from its own side. It doesn't all of a sudden pop into existence from its own causes. And, you know, we've been through this. You kind of realize this. But still we hold on to that. It's like what Venerable Gyaltsen was saying about these stories we think are true, you know, that they're actual things, and we get caught up in them. You know, and Geshe-la gave the example that, you know, we pay our rent if you're renting your apartment or mortgage or whatever, you know, with money, pieces of paper. But those pieces of paper have value only because we give them value. I'm holding in my hand a little piece of paper which contains information about how we recycle things when we take them to the dump here, what we can recycle, what we don't recycle, and so forth. But I can't pay my rent with this piece of paper. I can't pay my old taxes. I own the house. But I can't use this piece of paper to get groceries either, right? And if I'm holding a dollar bill in my hand, that doesn't tell me how or what I can recycle. They're pieces of paper, and that's it. But they have value only because we give them value ourselves. And in the case of money, paper money, you know, everybody sort of has the same karma to understand that we can use particular pieces of paper to buy things with. Or if we sell something, we get those pieces of paper. Or when we work, we get those pieces of paper. Those particular pieces of paper. And this is all due to the fact that if we get these pieces of paper, that we've taken care of other people in the past. You know, it doesn't come from our hard work today. It comes because we have helped others in the past. And that allows us to see these pieces of paper, or maybe a stack of them, as instruments to get things that we need, like food or a place to live or things like that. I can't use the piece of paper that tells me how to recycle to do those things. I have projected information onto that particular piece of paper about what we recycle. I've projected something we call money onto the other pieces of paper. So no good object in our life ever comes into existence for any reason except that we did a similar good thing to somebody in the past. And that's it. That's what things don't start from their own side means. Now, Arya Nagarjuna doesn't say from their own side. He just says things don't start. And then the number two is the opposite. Let's say Gakpa Mepa.
Gakpa Mepa.
Gakpa Mepa.
Gakpa Mepa.
Gakpa Mepa.
Gakpa Mepa.
Nothing stops. meaning things don't stop from their own side. Suppose you have a headache. You know, it eventually goes away. Why? It goes away because you've taken care of others in the past. Or maybe, you know, we normally say that karma runs out. But if you hadn't taken care of others in the past, if you harmed people, you might have a headache continually. But it does go away. The reason it goes away is because you've taken care of others in the past, probably people with headaches. Now, normally, if we get a headache, we take some aspirin or Advil or I don't know, whatever you have in Germany, you know, and we think that makes the headache go away. But that is the how, it is not the why. The reason the headache goes away is because you have taken care of people in the past, and let's say who have had headaches, making sure that we that the cause and the result are similar. And then you come up to me and say, well, I took two aspirin and nothing happened. I took a third one and the headache went away. So it's got to be the aspirin. But no, it isn't the aspirin. When you took the third aspirin, the karma of helping others kicked in and your headache went away. And this is what it means by things don't stop from their own side. We have to understand the reason that problems, for example, stop being problems for us. Karma stays with us. It's like an impression that we've made of our world. And that stays with us, you know. It's there. The karma of helping others that we've already generated is in our minds right now. It's an impression. And eventually, that will ripen into a pleasant experience for us. Where a pleasant experience can be something really, really nice, you know, like enjoying a good meal or loving somebody, getting a glimpse of your Buddha paradise, or it can be a pleasure of pain stopping. And sometimes those can be really good pleasures, especially if the pain was bad. But none of this happens independent of the fact that we've generated the causes for the pain to stop. Things don't stop from their own side. The pen you might be holding has ink in it. And eventually, there will be no more ink in it. Now, we think that that the pen runs out of ink, which is, of course, true. But the reason that the pen runs out of ink is because of the way that we treated others in the past. Like maybe taking pens away from them, something like that. It is not the fact that the pen from its own side runs out of ink. And we play nice little games here. Okay, the pen, yeah, certainly it's a projection of my mind, right? And I understand that. But when it runs out of ink, the pen, which now we think of as a self-existent pen, has run out of ink. We never think, oh, I took pens away from other people in the past. Now I have to put this pen aside and go get a new one, and hopefully I've got the karma to get a new pen. We never think that. But that is, in fact, what's going on. The idea that the pen is run out of ink from its own side is a story, you know, that we put upon pens. Number three, say takpa.
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 Good. Which means? Dot, dot, dot. What's me takpa? Oh, goodness. Sunday evening.
Unchanging?
Yeah, takpa's unchanging. Right. So Ari Nagarjuna says, things are unchanging. This is a way that we see things that is incorrect. So things are changing things, but we see them as unchanging. You know, it's the same thing as looking at your pen and understanding that there is a pen that exists all by itself out there, which I happen to be looking at right now. And that pen is unchanging. Things existing from their own side and unchanging are tied up together. Anything that exists from its own side has to be unchanging. And we see that, you know. But our world is a changing thing. It has to be. If it wasn't, we could never be anything but what we are right now. We would never reach our Buddha paradise. And, of course, you take it backwards, we would never have been born. We will always have existed, and we always will exist the way we are. So that's a wrong way of seeing things. And we can reason it out of our mind fairly quickly. Well, that's right. I was born, you know, and I was a baby, and I changed and grew and grew and grew, and now I'm an adult, and I'm making money, and eventually I'll die, which we're trying not to do. So it's easy to see things. Ourself is unchanging when we think about it. But when we reach a Buddha paradise, for example, when we become Buddhas, every object, everything in our world will bring total bliss to us. If things existed from their own side, they could never change. Yeah, chocolate cake is good. I love chocolate cake, you know. And it brings bliss to me now, and it will bring bliss to me when I'm a Buddha, in my Buddha paradise. But things I don't like canned spinach, for example, will bring bliss to me. When I was a kid, it made me throw up. Things like that will change. They have to change. Now, the canned spinach doesn't exist from its own side. It made me throw up because of the way I treated other people in the past. And chocolate cake brings me great pleasure because I have given other people great pleasure in the past by giving them chocolate cake, maybe, or something that they really like. We have to understand that. Takpa, this unchanging thing idea, you know, is the implication of things existing from their own side. Now, the opposite of that, number four, say chepa.
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 Chepa. Chepa means terminated or we could say stopped, maybe, even though it's not the same stop as before. But this is the idea that nothing exists. Number three, things are unchanging. Things exist from their own side. Number four, if things don't exist from their own side, then nothing exists. And that's a wrong view, too. It's a wrong idea. If we have this view, it sort of means that nothing matters. I don't need to keep my vows. I can do whatever I want. Whatever I do has no effect on me or anybody else because nothing exists from its own side. Nothing exists. So the opposite of things coming from their own side is that nothing exists at all. And we've talked about this before. It's the two extremes, which we're going to cover later today, by the way. The fifth way of misunderstanding our world, say drowa.
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 Yeah. Drowa, we've had before many times. It means to travel. or to go. And this is believing that things go. Now, it doesn't have to do with starting or stopping as far as motion goes. This is the idea that in order for a cause to turn into a result, the cause is destroyed when the result appears. The idea is that a cause goes, it travels toward a result, and that this is really happening independent of us making it happen in our minds. So it's the idea of a seed becoming a sprout. Now, when the sprout appears, the seed is no longer there. The seed is destroyed as it becomes a sprout. The wrong view here has to do with the fact that we think that this really exists from its own side. And then the next one, say Ongwa.
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 Yeah. Ong means to come or become. Ong also means future. The future comes eventually. We get there. But this is the looking at the seed becoming a sprout from the other end. The sprout comes into existence. It comes when the seed stops. When the seed is destroyed, the sprout comes. These two things, the going and the coming, or in English it's nice, coming and going, we think that this comes from its own side, meaning that there's no cause and effect in the way that we thought. Now, cause and effect are really good candidates for things being self-existent, or at least those things being self-existent. If there's a cause that produces a result, doesn't that have to be true, really true, that it's not my projection? And the answer, of course, is no. You know, in the springtime, we plant seeds, and we watch those become little plants of whatever it is that we plant. And it seems that that's really going on. You know, we're not there to make it happen. You know, the seed can become a sprout, can be a plant when we're inside sleeping. You know, we go to bed and there's a seed and we get up and there's a sprout. We had nothing to do with that. It happened all by itself. But this is false. There is cause and effect, but it doesn't work the way that we think it does. It does work. I mean, we see it work. But it's not the result of any quality of either the cause or the result. It is from our minds, the way we treated others in the past. So this idea that, you know, there is no coming or going, is code for us to begin to understand that even cause and result don't operate the way that we have normally thought that they did. You know, if somebody is giving you trouble at work, and if they're giving you trouble, it's probably unjust, right? It's not your fault. What do you do? What we've done in the past is maybe give them trouble back, you know, and that has gotten us nowhere. We're still in samsara. So you do something else. And what the Lojong tells us to do is to take the blame. Yes, you're right. You're absolutely right. I'm sorry. You know, Mark Twain in this country, you know, said something about, doing something good for other people, especially if they've been bad to us, is very effective. It makes some people happy, and it baffles the rest of the people. You know, why on earth did they do that? You know, but that's kind of the idea. You know, the Lojong teaches us in these situations, we don't try to justify our position. We don't tell our boss, well, I really didn't do that, you know. I know that he came to you earlier and said something about me, but I didn't do that, you know. It wasn't my fault. And the boss, we think, is going to say, oh, you're absolutely right. I misunderstood, you know, or I'll take him to something about that. You know, and that never happens. But you just take the loss upon yourself. You know, everything that happens to us is the result of the way we treated others in the past. It is a story that has come to us, and that story is an illusion. It's not really happening. We think it is, but it isn't. From its own side. Is it really happening to us? Well, yes, it is. Do you feel bad? Yes, you do, when somebody treats you unjustly. If you get hit by a car, was that an illusion? Yes. Was it really happening? No. Did it happen to you? Yes. Did it hurt? Yes. Did it break bones? Yes. You know, is it going to cost a lot of money in the hospital? Yes. All of those are true, but they are all projections. They are things that are happening to us because of the way we have treated others in the past. They come from us. The way to stop those things from happening is to give others the victory when we're treated unjustly. We take the blame ourselves. We give others the profit. And then the last pair, say, cheek.
Cheek.
And tade.
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 Cheek is the Tibetan word for one, the number one. And tade means many. It's sort of like a plural. So this is one or many. This is one of the five proofs of emptiness in the logic class, which we'll get to someday. And the idea is you look at your pen. Is the pen one or is it many? Well, we look at the pen. Well, there's just one pen here, so it's one. But somebody who's had a little bit of emptiness might say, well, the pen has parts, so it's many. Well, that's true too. But are the parts the pen? Yeah, all the parts together of the pen. You know, they're just assembled right now, and I've got a pen. And it works. I can write with it. But you go through this one versus many. Is it one? Is it many? And what we're really looking at, again, is it one from its own side or is it many from its own side? And it is neither of those. It is neither one nor many. Why? Because there's no pen from its own side either. And the reasoning is really sort of that simple, but of course it's a little more involved than that. And on the tape, as I was listening to it, Geshe-la was going through an argument with a debate with one of the students. And, you know, Geshe-la said, is it one or many? And the student kept trying to qualify his answer. And Geshe-la said, your only reply is yes or no. That's the only thing you get to say. But I have to know, you know, ultimately. Geshe-la said, I didn't say ultimately or conventionally. Is this a pen? Is this pen one or many? You know, and they went on and on and on and on about that. And Geshe-la then said, that's one of the reasons why debates sometimes go on for 5 hours. You have to establish really what you're talking about. So, one or many. If we're thinking about one or many, typically we're thinking about from its own side. You know, is the pen one from its own side or many from its own side? And then you have to get into that debate. Well, what are we really talking about? And the final, you know, thing is, well, it's neither from its own side. It's neither one from its own side or neither many from its own side, because there is no pen from its own side. So those are the eight wrong ways of looking at things. It's the eight mistaken ideas about the way things exist. Or we could say the eight mistaken ideas about emptiness, too. And then we get to two extremes. We're still on class number two. We'll get to class, today's class in a bit. So Chökyi Rinpoche, in his commentary on the eight verses, says that to be free from the chains of attachment, we have to give up the two extremes, which we've basically already talked about. And one extreme is believing that things are the way they look, the way they appear to us. Things appear to us to come from their own side. Things appear to us to be self-existent. That tendency is in every karmic seed that we have, because when we planted those things, we were seeing those things as self-existent. So everything that appears to us appears to be self-existent. And we have to give up that extreme. Things are not self-existent. They appear to be self-existent. They appear to come from their own side. You know, it's sort of like, you know, we're looking at the pen, and what our eyes are presenting to us is colors and shapes. And we are forced by our karma to organize these colors and shapes into pen. And not chew stick. Our karma makes us understand pen. We're forced by our past karma to do that. Just as we are forced by our past karma to believe things that exist from their own side. And we have to back off of that view. We have to not have that story in our minds. When we're in the office or wherever we are at work, you know, what are we perceiving? We are perceiving colors and shapes moving around. That's all that's there. But we organize those into coworkers. We organize one set of colors and shapes into the computer in front of us, if we have that, and our desk and the chair and so on and so forth. We make this up. We are forced by our karma to do that, just as we are forced by our karma to see them as self-existent. Now, there's nothing wrong with organizing the colors and shapes into whatever we perceive them to be. That's how we manage to exist in the world and get on with others. But we do have to give up the idea that these things come from our from their own side, which is part of our karma. And then the other extreme is believing that nothing exists. So we're at work and we're sitting there and we're watching these colors and shapes move around and reorganize themselves and appear differently and things like that. And we're thinking, that's all there is. There are no people here. There is no chair. There is no office. There is no me. Nothing exists at all. And that's an extreme we have to avoid, too. And we've been over this many, many times before. Buddhism is called the middle way because we have to not see things as self-existent, and we have to not see things as not self-existent, as not existent at all. We're in the middle. What we are perceiving does exist. It does not exist from its own side. And that's the middle way. And all schools teach that. You know, Lord Buddha taught the middle way. So, of course, all Buddha schools have to teach the middle way. They have different views of what that is, though. And that's okay. Okay, so now we're getting to today's class. We are going to study a Lojong or a series of Lojongs by a Kagyu Lama called Gyalpa Yangdunpa. His dates are 1213 to 1258. And Geshe-la told us that when the Lojong idea first arrived in Tibet, it was shortly after the really kind of formal transition of or injection of Buddhism into Tibet, which came with Lord Atisha. Now, Buddhism actually was introduced into Tibet around 700, 800, something like that. It existed for a century, maybe a little more, and then was stamped out by an evil king. And then it was reintroduced again. And the monastic tradition came in with Lord Atisha. The Lam Rim came in with Lord, well, he wrote the Lam Rim while he was in Tibet. And then these Lojong practices developed. And all the different lineages, there was no Gelugpa lineage then. There was Kagyu and there was Sakya and there was what we now call Nyingma. But they were all kind of the same. And they met with the Lojong practices. So Gyalpa Yangdunpa was a Kagyu Lama. And the Lojongs that he wrote were personal instructions that he wrote for his students. He passed them on to his students, probably one-on-one, but in a very intimate setting anyway. And these were his students that he passed these on to were they were at least 15-year students. They'd been studying Buddhism intently for 15 years. So this was almost like a tantric practice for them. The Lojong practices are open. They're not tantric, but they are very tantric, really, in what they're trying to do and how they're trying to change our mind. Gyalpa Yangdunpa was the founder, or at least one of the founders, of the Drupa Kagyu lineage, which is still around today. Drupa usually meant to Bhutan. It referred to the state of Bhutan, just below Tibet, sandwiched between India and whatever's on the other side. Burma, I guess. But the Drupa here refers to a region in Tibet. I don't know how many Kagyu lineages, at least 18, or maybe more than that. And the first word, Drupa Kagyu, Karma Kagyu, blah, 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 Kagyu, has to do either with a place or maybe the name of a teacher. It was common then that if a particular part of a practice appealed to a teacher, the teacher would concentrate on that, and he would teach his students that too. So the practice of a particular Kagyu lineage may have to do with the person who originated a particular form of practice, which was concentrating on one part of a larger practice. Gyalpa Yangdunpa's teacher was Sakya Pandita, who lived around 1200. And we've talked about him before. He was one of Tibet's greatest lamas. He went to Mongolia to pass Buddhism on to the Mongol kings. The king, one of the khans, demanded that he come. And while he was going there, every town he got to, they made him stop and teach them for a while. So Sakya Pandita sent his nephew, named Pakpa, on to Mongolia. He got to the court, and by the time Sakya Pandita got there, his nephew, who I think was 9 or something, had already taught Buddhism and converted the court to Buddhism. the nephew was a teacher of Kublai Khan. And he met Marco Polo. Geshe-la usually says that he met Marco Polo in the court of Kublai Khan. But he's also said that that he met Marco Polo in Beijing at the emperor's place. So I don't know which is right. I think the writing is from writings that took place at the emperor's palace, the record that Marco Polo met Sakya Pandita, or vice versa. Another one of Gyalpoyang Gunpa's teachers was Go Tsongkhapa, another great teacher, another great Lojong teacher. This is a really kind of special, precious tradition for us. Jetsong Kapa was a Kagyu. His ordination was Kagyu. One of his teachers, who was a close friend of his, was Sakya, and they taught each other. If you'll notice, Sakya Pandita was a teacher of Gyalpoyang Gunpa. So there's a link between the Sakya and Kagyu lineages right here in this Lojong. So he starts off. Gyalwa, by the way, means conqueror. And it's one of these respectful terms that we add to a name when we're talking about it. We don't say Tsongkhapa. We don't say Yang Gunpa. Or Nagarjuna, it's Arya Nagarjuna, or Master Nagarjuna, Master Asanga, Master Vasubandhu, Gyalwa, Yang Gunpa, and Gyalwa Gendendrup too, the first Dalai Lama. We put some respectful title ahead of them. So here's the first Lojong in this collection from Gyalwa Yang Gunpa. Nothing that starts remains unchanged. Have no attachment. Cut the ties. There's no happiness in this vicious circle. Get tired of it and find renunciation. The world is hollow and meaningless. Do not trust the lie. Your own mind is the Buddha. Go and meet your friend. And that's it. That's the entire Lojong, this first one. We have to dig deeply to understand what this means. It seems kind of new agey if you just read it sort of at face value. In the last two lines here, your own mind is the Buddha. That refers to our Buddha nature. It doesn't refer to this little Buddha inside of us, this wrong idea that many people in Tibet had and many people today have, you know, that we're already a Buddha. It's covered up inside of us, and all we have to sort of do is shine that up and we'll be a Buddha. But that's not what it means. Your own mind is the Buddha, refers to the Buddha nature. What is that? It is the fact that the emptiness of our mind and the emptiness of a Buddha's mind are exactly the same. Our mind has no nature of its own. A Buddha's mind has no nature of its own. Because our mind is not unchanging, because it's not self-existent, we can change it. How do we change it? By collecting the necessary karma. And one of the ways to do that, as we saw in the last Lojong teaching, is to take the loss ourselves, to give other people the benefit when we're treated unfairly. And you can think, you know, if in your last life you had collected all the good karma you need for a Buddha paradise, that's where your mind would be right now, in its Buddha paradise. You would be perceiving your mind as the mind of an enlightened being. And that would be really neat. You know, that's what the people in a retreat are trying to do. They're trying to generate the karma to change their mind, to be able to see themselves as an enlightened being. You know, that's the point of our practice. It's the point of Mahayana practice. Even in the open teachings, that's the point, to generate the karma to perceive our minds as being the mind of a Buddha, an enlightened being. In Tantra, we just do that very, very quickly. So if you really understood the nature of your mind, you know, that is the potential. It has the potential to become a Buddha. We would keep our vows perfectly. We would do all the things that we need to do to force ourselves to see our mind as being the mind of an enlightened being. And then he goes on, another part of another Lojong that he wrote. Nothing but the Dharma means anything at all. Throw the rest out like trash. It all boils down to dying. Pack light and take off now. So it all boils down to dying. What we do is throughout the day, whenever we start an activity or whatever we're doing, keep in mind that we are going to die, and suppose that we knew that we had 1 hour to live. Is what we're doing right now the thing that we want to wind up doing just before we die? You know, is it a good thing to be doing? Is what I'm doing right now generating the causes for me to perceive my mind as a lightened being? If it's not, then I throw it out like the trash. You know, it's just like trash. It means nothing to me. Nothing but the Dharma means anything at all. We do have to go through our life. We have familial responsibilities, for example. We have responsibilities to friend. If we're running a company, we have responsibility to the company, to our employees. But nothing but the Dharma means anything. Does that mean you give all that up? No. What it means is you change the way you look at it. Is what I'm doing right now the thing that I should be doing if it were the case that I would die in an hour? And we have to evaluate that. You know, that's what this very simple Lojong means. So we spend our life doing Dharma activity, even if it's at work, especially when it's at work, or especially when we're at home with our families. You know, if you're parents, you got to deal with kids. If you're married, you got to deal with a spouse, and so on. And that becomes a practice. And as we're doing that, is ask ourselves, is this what I should be doing right now? If you're having a fight with your spouse, is that really what you want to, the last thing you should do before you die? Is it promoting you? Is it toward forcing yourself to see your mind as an enlightened being? And if it's not, you just give it up. And then there's another Lojong of Gelwa Yongdupa called the Six Keys. And they're really kind of neat. The first one is, put your death in your heart. This is the key for checking whether your practice is tuned too tight or too loose. If you saw a movie called The Little Buddha, when Lord Buddha, before he's Lord Buddha, is with the six ascetics and practicing severe hardship. He's not making any progress, and he figures that out, but he doesn't know what's wrong. And there's a canoe in the river going by with two people in it, and somebody is saying to the other one, like a guitar string, you know, if it's too tight, it won't work. If it's too loose, it won't work. And right there, Buddha gets the idea, ah, right. And that's where the middle way kind of came from. And that's what this this line is talking about. You know, would you be doing what you're doing if you were going to die? And that's the same question again, you know. If what you're doing is too tight, we use the word anal, you know. You're just all, it's got to be this way, it's got to be that way, and things don't change, you know. What I'm doing is the way it's supposed to be, or what I'm thinking is the way it's supposed to be. That's too tight. And then the too loose, oh, well, you know, I could do it tomorrow or it doesn't really matter. These kind of things, you know. Yeah, maybe. And you're not applying logic to it, perhaps. You know, that's too loose. So you apply those criteria as you're evaluating what you're doing. You know, am I tuned too tight? Am I tuned too loose? And if either of those is true, then you change what you're doing. The second key. Think of the viper's nest of the problems of this life. This is the key for stopping attachment at the bottom of your heart, or from the bottom of your heart. We know about the third kind of suffering. As the second kind of suffering, you know, every good thing that happens to us will cease happening. It will go away. So we think about that too. Every good thing in our life will eventually be stripped away from us. Certainly when we die, but probably before that too. You know, if you've got children, they're going to grow up and go away. Your relationship with your spouse may end. You may become poor, and so on. Any good thing in your life will eventually disappear. You know, and we've been over this time and time and time again. But what this is talking about is don't become attached to those things for the reason that they're going to disappear. A good friend of mine in California, the last time I saw her, she'd had a horrible year. I hadn't seen her for like 3 years. And her husband had a heart attack. And her two children were keeping their children, her grandchildren, from seeing her. She had become sort of like a witch to them. And one daughter was even so unthinking as to bring her family to spend Thanksgiving with the people living next door to this woman, to my friend, people that she hardly even knew, just to taunt her mother. And she was having she said the year was horrible. And she told me, she told Lama Zopa about that, you know. She hadn't seen him in a while. And it just kind of broke down. And she finished and he said, "You really have had a bad year." And he just gathered her up in his arms and held her for a little bit. Lama Zopa never touches anybody. So, you know, this was really something amazing. And then he said, "What did you learn from all this?" And she said, "I've learned that you can't take refuge in family, and I've learned that you can't take refuge in health." And he said, "Well, that's pretty good, you know." And that's what this line is about. You know, don't get attached to the nice things in your life, because they will disappear. And then what have you got? You know, you'll feel bad if you're attached to them. Number three, let every thought be of what other people need. This is the key for making everything you do in the Dharma. For making everything you do the Dharma. You know, and so you're going about your life, you know, you're working in Munich or thereabouts.
you might have a normal family. But as you're doing these things, you keep in the back of your mind that whatever you are doing is for somebody else. You start that, and then it becomes for a lot of people, for your family, for the people at work, you know, for your friends. And then everybody, you always have in the back of your mind this idea that what I'm doing right now is for the benefit of everybody else. And this is a little bit different, you know, from the first two, is what I'm doing what I want to be doing, you know. Assume you've done that. Now you keep in the back of your mind that what it is that you are doing is for the benefit of others. So you keep that there. Number four, don't think of anything but your lama. You know, this is the key for turning your mind and theirs into the same thing, into one. This is called guru yoga, by the way. But, you know, this is the idea that we keep our lama in our minds all the time. We got to keep a lot of things in our mind, in case you haven't figured that out yet. You spend your whole day thinking about your lama. What good qualities your lama has. What qualities you want for yourself. You know, we do this when we start a meditation. This is part of the seven-part prayer. And you keep that in mind, you know. I think Geshe-la, what do I like about him? What about him is what I want to be too. You know, what would he do in this situation, and so on. And you just keep that in there, you know. So as you go about your day, your lama's there with you. And you try to be your lama, you know, try to act as your lama would, try to think as your lama would. And eventually, you develop this pure mind, which is the mind that you wanted, the mind of your lama, which is the mind of an enlightened being. Number five, see the world and the people in it as angels. This is the key for stopping the idea that life is an ordinary thing. And this is very important, too. It is the basis of tantric practice. When you get to Dalam, which is the first, it's not really a secret, but it's the Lam Rim cast in terms of tantra, that you will be instructed. If you receive teachings from us, you know, that you may now never again look at anything as normal. So you see things as pure. You want to do that. The people around you are there to help you become enlightened. They are angels. They are pure beings. They have done it. And they're helping us do it too by showing us. And this involves seeing other people as angels, seeing everything in your world as pure, actually helps you keep your vows better. It helps you maintain your practice. And things will change for you. Your life will begin to transform. It will be gradual, but it will occur. And if you're doing it in a tantric setting, then the changes will occur very quickly. Your world will become your Buddha paradise. You will see it happen. But in order to do that, we have to stop seeing things as normal. You know, the person who's giving you a hard time at the office is coming from you. And you transform that into seeing them as an angel. That's also coming from you, right? We're just changing our perception. But you've got to start doing things like that. You kind of have to force yourself to do it in order for these changes to begin to take place, in order for you to begin generating karma that will generate your Buddha paradise for you. So you stop seeing things as normal. Things are not the way they appear to be. I learned that early on. I didn't know why, but it seemed to make sense, you know, that nothing is the way it seems to be. We were sort of told, you know, many things are not the way they seem to be. But I right away said, well, this is stupid. Nothing is the way it seems to be. And now I know why. You know, the more that we study, the more we learn. The more we keep our vows, the better you are at keeping your book. The more the bad karma disappears and the more good karma is reinforced. And the more good things you do. And that's what changes your world. The world isn't what we think it is. And if we're smart, we don't like the world the way it appears to us. If we like it, there's no reason to change it. So, and this seems kind of weird, too. You know, if we see people yelling at us, we have to understand, well, that's not what it appears to be. And we can say, okay, I know that's coming from myself, but it's still yelling nonetheless. You know, that's what I'm experiencing it as. My karma's forcing me to see that. But now, just because things aren't the way they appear to be, can we change the appearance? And that's what this one is about. Yes, we must change the appearance. And we kind of have to force it itself at first. But we can do it. And number six, whatever comes, make it crystal. This is the key for making this life turn to freedom all by itself. Crystal means that we have to understand that things are empty. They have no nature of their own. They are completely neutral. They are clear, we might say. So we also have to make sure we don't take this verse as I'll use the term new agey again, right? It's not, oh, everything is crystal. Isn't that nice, you know? It's not that way. Everything is empty. Nothing has any nature of its own. Everything is clear. And this sort of comes from the last part of where we see things as pure. Everything is crystal. Everything is pure. Everything is neutral, which is maybe why it's pure. So we have to work at this. We have to understand that things are empty. We don't now. I mean, you can teach other people about how things are empty, and maybe you have already. When Alejandro was giving his talk yesterday, he was using the pen as the example, you know, and he said, this was the more important thing that came into my mind, and I teach it over and over and over and over again. I tell everybody about it, and I have a clue about what I'm talking about. Meaning for him that the only way he could understand the pen was empty was through logic. It did not appear to him that way. Even when he's holding the thing in front of him saying it's empty, it appears to him as empty. And so we get to this, you know, everything is empty, and we have to begin to understand that. Nirvana, the elimination of our mental afflictions, is not automatic. We have to make it happen. You know, in Christian teachings, the key to getting to heaven, taught by many preachers, you know, many Catholicism and many of the Protestant things, is faith in Jesus. If you have faith in Jesus, you'll get to heaven. And this is absolutely wrong. You know, Jesus said, if you want to be like me, do what I do. And it's easy, you know. Okay, I've got the answer. I see everything is crystal. I understand that. That's all I need to know, and everything will be perfect. Not true. You got to work at it. you have to work at seeing things as are empty, you know. And all the retreatants were talking about things like that. It comes to them in a very difficult way. Even some advanced non-direct perceptions require a tremendous amount of work. But it can happen. You have to make tremendous effort. You got to keep your vows. And you practice these lojongs very, I guess Geshe-la likes the word sweetly, you know, just pure. You have fun doing it. And finally, we get to the five mental poisons. And this is another, well, it's not finally, we got more to go. This is another lojong by the same author. Mental poisons, we could call mental afflictions. And they're horrible. You know, when you get angry or jealous or something like that, it sort of takes things over. And the more you practice and the more you try to keep your vows, you know, the more you do your book, the worse these attacks of mental afflictions become for you. They can make you physically sick. They can make you unable to function at work. Geshe-la told us his main affliction, which I think he's overcome, but his main mental affliction was jealousy. Anytime anybody got something they wanted, he would be jealous of them. He said it particularly applied to other people teaching, either his contemporaries or even some of Rinpoche's students or maybe even his own students. And he said it would ruin his ability to concentrate. Ken Rinpoche would make him, he made all his students memorize things. And Geshe-la learned how to memorize at the monastery. And he could do it very quickly. But he said one time he was trying to memorize something, and something happened, and this attack of jealousy came on, and he could not memorize until he took care of it. He said it lasted about 15 minutes. He could not memorize. This attack, this poison, kept his mind from having the ability to memorize a text, and he couldn't separate the two. So these five poisons, we really have to understand and work at getting rid of them. And nirvana is getting rid of them. Once you've gotten rid of them. So the first one, say duchak.
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 Duchak means like attachment, but it's ignorant liking. Liking things ignorantly. There's nothing wrong with liking something. You can enjoy a good meal. You can enjoy a good movie. You can enjoy your friends. You can enjoy companionship. But liking something ignorantly means that you think that it is what brings you the pleasure, and you would therefore harm somebody else to get it in some way. That's what ignorant liking is. And the result is harming somebody. You know, that's what it can lead to. The ignorant part is you don't understand that the pleasure you get is coming from the way you've treated others in the past. So what happens then if you get rid of ignorant liking? So say Deva Tamche.
Deva Tamche.
Deva Tamche.
Deva
Tamche.
Deva Tamche.
Deva Tamche.
Deva Tamche.
Deva means happiness, and Tamche means all. So you get all the happiness you want When you stop liking things ignorantly, when you stop being attached to things, but you understand when good things happen to you, when pleasure occurs, that it's the way you treated others in the past, then more and more things, good things begin to happen to you. You get all the happiness you want. You refused to see things ignorantly as coming from their own side and not coming from you. And if you refuse to do that, then things do come to you. If you don't refuse to do that, you then cause yourself to lose these things because now they are coming to you ignorantly, just sort of normally, you know, and all good things go away. And because you're not draining the causes to have the good things happen again, they don't happen for a while again. And it seems like nothing good happens to you. The second poison, say Shedong.
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 Shedong is a word often used, translated as anger. But basically, this is disliking things stupidly. Again, there's nothing wrong in disliking something. There was really nothing wrong with my disliking canned spinach. As long as I didn't understand that it was coming from the canned spinach and not me. You know, we don't like our suffering. There's nothing wrong with not liking suffering. There's nothing wrong with not liking the fact you get angry, for example, or jealous. There's nothing wrong with that at all. But the wrong thing is to think that the things that you don't like because whatever qualities you don't like come from the thing. That's the ignorant part about it. And then the outcome of disliking things ignorantly is that you would hurt somebody. You would harm somebody to keep that thing away from you, especially if that thing is some person. So what happens when you stop disliking things ignorantly? Say, Dungyao?
Dungyao?
Rang?
Rang?
Drewa.
Drewa.
Dungel is suffering. Dong here means from. And Jawa means freedom. So, if you stop disliking things stupidly, what happens? No more pain at all. Which is nirvana. And so we see how these first two, anyway, are tied up with keeping us not only from nirvana, but having a direct perception of emptiness, of making any progress in our practice whatsoever. And these first two have to do with number three, say Timuk.
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 Now, this means ignorance. Normally, we think of Ma Rigpa as ignorance. Timuk means more. It's more like confusion. It's a word used when they're talking about fog, for example. It's unclear, you know. It's not understanding how the world really works or how our mind really works. It's believing the appearance of things, and we get confused. We think that the yelling boss is really a yelling boss from its own side. We're confused about that. Where does the yelling boss come from? Me. But I'm confused. I think the yelling boss is really out there, yelling at me. And I don't understand that. Timuk, ignorance, you know, it's the 1 o'clock position on the wheel of life. It's the very first thing. It's what leads to ignorant liking and ignorant disliking. We are confused. We don't see it clearly. Maybe not even clear, we don't see it at all. We don't see what's the real nature of what's happening, of what's going on. So if we eliminate ignorance, you know, that 1 o'clock position, everything else that happens in the wheel of life ceases happening, which is really kind of neat. And what happens if we do that? Say, Jung Chuk Topa.
Jung Chuk Topa.
Jung Chuk Topa.
Jung Chuk Topa.
Yeah, it means, Jung Chuk is enlightenment, and Topa means fruition. So if we cease our ignorance, we achieve enlightenment. Now, we can reach enlightenment when we stop reacting to the world. To the world and the way that we usually react to it. That's the key, you know. We understand, we begin to react to things, understanding that what we're experiencing is coming from us, from the way that we treated others in the past. And if we start doing that, then we begin on the path to achieve enlightenment for ourselves. Now, this goes beyond nirvana. We can still have ignorance and reach nirvana. We have to get rid of ignorance, all aspects of ignorance, in order to achieve enlightenment. So we can really get there. If we break ignorance, we can get to enlightenment. You know, Lord Buddha said an interesting thing. He was talking about the hell realms. And he said, where do you think the hell realms came from? You know, did Acme Construction go down there and build it, take a lot of steel and barbed wire and gas furnaces and everything else and build this place? Do you think that somebody built that? Really? He said, no. You know, you can probably figure that out. The hell realms come from your perceptions. That's all. You know, just as the perceptions we're having right now come from us, they can change and become a hell realm for us. Nobody made the hell realms. Nobody made a Buddha paradise that we just sort of step into at some point. We do that ourselves. The fourth poison, you know this one, Nagyal, pride. And this is the wrong pride, you know. The wrong pride is where you see yourself higher than other people. Remember the first line of the 8-verse mind training is to see others, see yourself as lower than other people. Well, this is the opposite, seeing yourself as higher. And typically pride pushes people down so that you're higher. And it's not good. Now, there can be good pride. You know, you can feel happy. You can feel good about something good that you've done. You know, the first time that you've conquered an angry response or a jealous response or something like that, you can feel really good about that. You know, I did it. I did that. That was me. I've done it. You know, you can feel proud about the fact that you did that, you know. You can feel proud about doing a Lojong practice because not many people on this planet do it. You know, you are working. You're doing that for everybody else. You're changing your mind actively. Now, what happens if you happen to eliminate pride? Say, Rango Tunba.
Rango Tunba.
Rango Tunba.
Rango Tunba.
Rango Tunba.
Rango Tunba.
Rango sounds sort of like a movie that was going on Rango here in the United States. I was sort of surprised to see this Tibetan. But this means totally independent. When you eliminate pride, you know, you have everything that you need. You've got money, you've got knowledge, you've got whatever, compassion. You are sufficient unto yourself when you eliminate the bad kind of pride, right? You don't need anything else. You could say now that the pride you do have is the good pride, the good nagil, which in Tantra is divine pride. You've got immorality when that happens. You can meditate. You can gain wisdom through your meditation. You could stand on your own independently. You are strong for other people. You look like a pillar of strength to other people. They can sense it right away. You may already have had the experience, you know, of somebody say, how come you're always so upbeat or whatever, or calm or whatever like that? And if you haven't, that will come. It's obvious to other people, some other people, you know. And that's good. That's what happens when you get rid of the pride. And the fifth of the five poisons, say tracto.
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 Jealousy. And this is the state of mind where you are unhappy when people get things that they want. And this is a horrible thing, you know. If you think this way, you will wind up not getting the things that you want. There will always be obstacles to getting the things that you want. Because you've been jealous of other people, you've felt bad when they get, or angry when they get the things that they want. So, you know, the result, similar to the cause, is you don't get the things that you want. You will not make any progress in your practice if this is a serious affliction for you, and so on. So what happens when you remove jealousy? Say, get tam che.
Get tam che.
Get tam che.
Selva.
Selva.
Get tam che.
Get tam che.
Selva.
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 Yeah, get means obstacle, and tam che means all. And selva means to remove them. So you remove the obstacles to your practice. What this means is, in practical terms, is now you have been celebrating when others get things that they want. You might even help them get things that they want to overcome the jealousy. And if you do that, then you get the things that you want. The obstacles to getting what you want are removed. Okay, so now we get to the last thing. This is a part of one of the last Lojong in your reading. It says, the reality of things is beyond the mind. So reside in a state where you hold to nothing. This is something that you should not teach to students who haven't received lots of training. They'll misunderstand it. The reality of things is beyond the mind, meaning that we're never going to understand, or we don't need to worry about how things really are. And this is false. And the second part of this, you know, so reside in a state where you hold to nothing is a lot like nothing exists at all. So it doesn't make any difference what I know. And that's not what this means. In Lojong, it means that we don't really understand the nature of things until we have a direct perception of emptiness. We haven't seen reality at all until we've had a direct perception of emptiness. So mind here really means the conceptual mind. You know, the reality of things is beyond that conceptual mind. The conceptual mind cannot understand the actual reality of things at all. Now, this doesn't mean that we're not experiencing reality in our everyday world. It doesn't mean that we're not encountering the emptiness of things. Things are empty, even though we don't perceive that. So we are encountering the emptiness of things all the time. We just don't understand that that's what's going on. And it's important, you know, we do experience things in everyday life. We're constantly experiencing things. We have these stories that we're constantly inventing to go around our experiences. The stories are how we connect the experiences. But what this line means, the reality of things is beyond the mind, is that we must not hold to the fact that things are coming from their own side. We cannot do that. We can't think of our own body and mind as a normal, unenlightened body and mind that is never going to be anything except that. If our current body and mind come from their own side, they will never be anything else than what they are right now. And we can't think that way. We can't let ourselves do that. So reside in a state where you hold on to nothing, meaning that we stop holding on to the body and mind that we think exist that don't exist at all. You know, so reside in the state of a mind where we hold on to nothing. We don't grasp to things that don't exist anymore. That's what this is about. And that is difficult to explain to a new student, let alone just give them these two lines and expect them to understand it. They'll get a completely wrong idea. So this is an example of something that you wouldn't teach. This was part of those teachings that were only passed on, from teacher to student individually or in very small groups, say two or three, after they've been studying for 15 years or so. So that's the class for today. If you have any questions, I would be happy to answer.
Venerable Phil.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for the class. That was wonderful. And I have a question. Did you really say that you can still have ignorance and reach nirvana, but have to eliminate all of root ignorance to reach Buddhahood? Did I understand that right?
You understood that correctly.
You can still have ignorance and reach nirvana.
Right. Now, ignorance here, in order to reach nirvana, you had to have had a direct perception of emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
That's required. But in and if you're on the Mahayana path, that's Bodhisattva ground 7. That's the equivalent of reaching nirvana, meaning that all of your mental afflictions are gone and they will never, ever again occur. But grounds 8, 9, and 10 have to do with removing the last parts of ignorance, which is perceiving things incorrectly. On ground 8, for example, you eliminate the tendency for the appearance, for things to appear self-existent. You will eliminate that tendency so that things no longer appear to be self-existent. That appearance never again occurs to you. And then on grounds 9 and 10, you're basically polishing up correct ways of understanding things based on your understanding of emptiness, which now you've had a direct perception of that, and the fact that things no longer appear as self-existent. So there's just a little bit of ignorance left over when you reach nirvana.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. One other question, totally not Do you maybe have an idea if the quiet retreat teachings are recorded for us or something like that?
They are. Yeah.
Oh.
You'll be able to get these online. They didn't stream them because we can't do that from Diamond Mountain very easily. But they will be on I don't know what site. I think if you look at ACI Phoenix website, you'll be able to find them. I don't know. Venerable Jigme is making them. And I don't know whether she's gotten Friday's and yesterday's teachings up or not. But they'll be up soon. Yeah, so you'll be able to see the retreatants giving their talks.
Okay.
And Geshe-la giving his Lama Rim teachings.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they are wonderful. They are awesome.
Yeah, really good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Welcome. Anybody else?
Mm-mm.
Okay.